that Solomon went out and he pursued everything. He pursued money. He pursued power. He pursued land, cattle, leisure. He pursued all of it. And in Ecclesiastes 12, verse 8, the conclusion he came to from those pursuits was, the pursuit of happiness. Boy, everybody wants to be happy, right? You know, even our founding fathers of this great nation recognized in the Declaration of Independence that there are certain inalienable rights that all of us are endowed by the Creator with, and among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Everybody wants to be happy. It even shows up in our popular culture. Bobby McFerrin's song, Don't Worry, Be Happy. I mean, that, now that that's in your head, that probably won't leave for a while. Pharrell Williams had a song called Happy. Talked about how happy he was. I'm happy, happy, happy. And then there's Phil Robertson, a member of our own fellowship in Louisiana, who's very famous for his quote, happy, 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 when people would ask how things are going and things like that. He would emphasize that he's happy. Here in the U.S., we valiantly pursue happiness. I really couldn't get good numbers for 2020 because of the pandemic and all of that. But in 2019, here in the United States, we spent $1.1 trillion on travel abroad, going on vacation, going out to see the world. We spent $56 billion on tickets to sporting events. I thought the tickets to the Rays games were high this year. $56 billion left our pockets to go to sporting events. $11 billion on movie tickets. This one kind of surprised me. $459 billion on outdoor recreation of all sorts, whether that be playing baseball, football, whatever, skiing, water sports, those kind of things. $459 billion. And then lastly, $1 trillion on electronics. Yes, we love our goodies and our gadgets, and we all want to be happy, and I'm reminded of a commercial that the Ford Motor Company had back in the early 60s when the Ford Mustang was first introduced. And it featured a guy by the name of Walter. Now, Walter was a bookkeeper. And they showed Walter in a dingy little office where he would very diligently grind out his numbers. And then at lunch, he would take his sack lunch that contained his bologna sandwich and his chips and would walk to the park and sit there and eat them. And as he was sitting there eating them, people would pass by, men, women, they would all pass by and never notice Walter. But Ford Motor Company had a solution for Walter. It was the Ford Mustang. And they showed Walter, after he bought his new 66 Mustang Fastback GT, that suddenly, when he walked into the office, everybody noticed him. The secretaries noticed him, the boss noticed him, gave him a raise. He'd grab his lunch, and attractive women would flock him and would grab him up and take him out to lunch in restaurants. The Ford Mustang changed Walter's life. How many thousands of people do you think, like Walter, bought a Mustang and are still waiting on all of that to happen to them? Madison Avenue has created an entire industry that is focused on convincing you that their product will make you happy. And that all you've got to do is get this product or go to this event and you will be happy. But you know, mankind has pursued happiness forever. There was a man, man King Solomon. Now, if you want to find a guy that would, anything you ever heard about Jeff Bezos or the Walton family, or Steve Jobs, or whoever the richest, wisest, smartest person you can think of. Wrap all of those together, and that was Solomon. Solomon was known as the wisest and the richest person alive at that time. Even Solomon pursued happiness. In Ecclesiastes 3, he says, "I know that there is nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in their toil. This is the gift of God." Even Solomon recognized that happiness comes from God. But you know what Solomon did in his man or human orientation? He decided to pursue happiness. And if you read the book of Ecclesiastes, and I highly recommend it, what you're going to find is that Solomon went out and he pursued everything. He pursued money, he pursued power, he pursued land, cattle, leisure. He pursued all of it. And in Ecclesiastes 12, verse 8, the conclusion he came to from those pursuits was, "Meaningless, meaningless," says the teacher, "everything is meaningless." So here's the smartest, richest, most successful person that the world has ever known that went out and pursued those things and said, "You know, all of those pursuits are meaningless. Nothing brings me happiness." And he concludes Ecclesiastes by saying in verse 13, "Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God. Keep his commandments, for this is the duty of mankind." Even Solomon recognized that happiness comes only from God. Jesus promises us real happiness. We all want to be happy. You know, he provides us real happiness and real blessing. You know, here in the U.S., especially if you live in the South, our vocabulary has severely abused the word bless. And if you've ever come in contact with a Southern matriarch, you will know this, because she will bless your heart and extend all kinds of blessings to you. And what she's really saying is, you know, you tried hard. You had great intentions. Son, bless your heart. I know you struck out, but bless your heart. We have severely abused that word, bless. Blessed, as used by Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, as recorded in Matthew chapter 5, is from the Greek makaros, which means to be happy or blissful. It also means a self-contained happiness. Happiness that comes from inside. Happiness that comes from who you are. You know, I've observed over time, and I've taught at all levels, from the lower grades all the way up through college, and I've lost track of the number of people who would say, "You know, if I could just buy that Ford Mustang, or if I could just take this summer break trip, or if I could just get the attention of that certain girl or that certain guy, they will make me happy." I'm here to tell you that as hard as I might try, I am not going to make you happy. And there will be times that you will be very unhappy with me. There's some people in the audience that could probably testify to that. Nobody or no thing is going to make you happy. It's just not going to happen. Blessed, as Jesus used it, also means approved by God. So how does Jesus tell us that we will get blessings or this happiness that comes from within. How does he tell us that? First of all, let me just say that as Christians, we are not promised the material things that makes the world happy. Jesus does not promise you a Ford Mustang. Jesus did not promise you the house, that house in that gated community that has all the amenities and all of that. He doesn't promise us that. In fact, Paul, in writing to Timothy, says, "And having food and clothing with these, we shall be content." Over the years, Ruth and I have had the opportunity to go on several medical missions to some third world countries. And one of the places we went was Montego Bay, Jamaica. Now, those of you who've traveled on vacation, well, wait a minute, that's a tourist destination. I can tell you that you only have to get about a block off the main streets, and you will find people who are living in cardboard boxes. They love to get a hold of a refrigerator box. That can be their home for a year. And they may not even have a full change of clothes. But some of the happiest people that I have met were some of those people that lived in cardboard boxes, had only the clothes on their back and some food. They found joy and contentment from their very, what we would consider very, very subsistence level existence. Jesus shows us the way to eternal happiness and earthly happiness. Matthew 5, verse 3, as we begin the what are known as the Beatitudes, says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God." We're not talking, when we say the poor in spirit, you may be saying, no, wait a minute. You know, so if I have a bad self-concept, if I wear sackcloth and ashes, and if I constantly beating myself up, that's what I got to do? No. When Jesus is talking about the poor in spirit, what he's talking about is not like the one talent man that we see recorded in Matthew 25, where the guy says, "And I was afraid, and I went and I hid your talent because I was afraid of you." And it's not like the cowardly spies that we see in Numbers, where they said, "We can't go into that land." No, what we're talking about is we're referring to those who are humble. And when I talk about humility, when I talk about humble, what we're talking about is realizing our insignificance compared to God. I know a number of people have said, "Now wait a minute, Bill. It says in Genesis that we were created in God's own image. And doesn't that make me kind of like God? I was made in His image." Well, what I will tell you is we are a very poor copy or a very poor replica of God. In fact, the same people that would tell me, would ask me about that, "Aren't we created in God's image?" they overlooked Genesis 6:6, where God looks at mankind and saw how bad we were and regretted having ever created us. We have to, in order to be poor in spirit, as Jesus is talking about, we have to recognize our relationship to God and recognize the superiority of God and the overarching greatness and goodness of God. Matthew 5:4, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted." This is not saying that everyone who mourns will be comforted. And not all mourning leads to comfort. Consider Judas, who sold out Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. He mourned terribly and drove himself to suicide. We're not talking about that. What we're talking about is found in 2 Corinthians 7, verses 9 and 10, where it says, "Now I rejoice, not that you were made sorry, but that your sorrow led to repentance. For you were made sorry in a godly manner, that you might suffer loss from us for nothing. For godly sorrow produces repentance, leading to salvation, not to be regretted. But the sorrow of the world produces death. So when Jesus is saying that blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted, we're talking about godly sorrow, recognizing our fallibility, the things that we've done wrong, the sins that we have committed against God and other people, and recognize that and have that sorrow that leads to repentance. That's the sorrow. That's the mourning that Jesus is talking about. Jesus also says, blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. We have a misperception about what being meek is in this country. This is not the guy that kind of hides in the corner, shrinks in the corner, and doesn't want to talk to people, is afraid to talk to people, or is that 98-pound weakling that has sand kicked in his face all the time. That's not what we're talking about. Meekness is the opposite of self-absorption. To be meek, as Jesus is using it, is to not be absorbed with ourselves. It's not all about me. And I think if we took a poll here, every one of us knows somebody who is so narcissistic and self-absorbed that it's all about them. Now, that doesn't mean that we're to have a bad self-concept. That doesn't mean that we're to continually beat ourselves. What it says is we must not be occupied, preoccupied with self and extolling our own virtues and so forth. I had an uncle whose life motto was, if you don't toot your own horn, nobody's going to toot it. And let me tell you, he tooted it a lot. He was self-absorbed. I recognize that. Loved him despite his faults. But he was self-absorbed. I had a business partner one time who was the same way. His life was a constant campaign to convince people how good he was and how valuable he was to you. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about meekness is not occupied with self and has an orientation towards others, as it talks about in Philippians 2, verses 3 and 4, where it says, consider others better than yourself and look out for the interests of others. Not being self-absorbed. That's what we're talking about, meek. Meekness is also a willingness to take wrong patiently. Wrong way. 1 Peter 2, verses 19 and 20. For this is commendable, if because of conscience towards God, one endures grief and suffering wrongly. For what credit is it to you when you are beaten for your own faults and you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer, you take it patiently. This is commendable before God. When we receive abuse, when we receive criticism from the world for our belief in God and for our practice of Christianity, we're to take that patiently. Now, you may say, well, wait a minute, Bill. We live in the United States. We have freedom of religion. We can worship. We don't have people sitting outside our doors ready to bust up our service here this morning. And that's true. But how many of you in the workplace, when there's an office gathering after work and you know the behaviors are going to be exhibited, decline to go, and you know there's the whispering behind you, or my middle schoolers and my high schoolers, when you're walking the halls of your school and somebody sees your orange shirt and says, he goes to church all the time. He doesn't get to sleep in on Sunday. Don't ask him to do anything on Saturday night because he's not going to go. We're to take those kinds of things patiently and live our lives and let our lives be an example to those around us. When we refuse to take part in the coarse language that other people might use in the locker room or out on the sports field, when we conduct ourselves the way that we know that Christians are to conduct ourselves and we receive criticism for it because, well, you just don't have enough testosterone, you're not enough of a man to do that. We're to take those criticisms patiently, and this, according to Peter, is commendable before God. That doesn't mean that you take that, as it says there, for what credit is it to you when you are beaten for your own faults, when you make a mistake, when you do things bad and you suffer the punishments. You go ahead and take those, and if they're not right, then you protest it. But when you take criticism for being a Christian, we're to take it patiently and to show our nature as Christians. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. This indicates a strong desire for righteousness, a strong desire to live that Christian life. It becomes a matter of life and death to the person. The example is given in Psalm 42. As the deer pants for the water brooks, so my soul pants after you. Do you pursue righteousness? Do you thirst for righteousness? Does it drive you the way that hunger and thirst would? You want true happiness? You want the happiness that can come from Jesus? It's to pursue that righteousness, to go after that, to begin, whether that be in your studies, but also through your daily life. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Here we are told to imitate God. God, in Hebrews 8, verse 12, it says, I will be merciful to their unrighteousness. For their sins and lawless deeds, I will remember no more. That's what God does for you as a Christian. Their sins and their unrighteousness and their sins and their lawless deeds will be no more. God forgets it. I think one of the spiritual barometer that God uses most in evaluating us is the nature of our relationships with those around us. Are you merciful to other people? Do you show them mercy and forgiveness when they wrong you? In that prayer that the Lord demonstrated to us, known as the Lord's Prayer, can you really stand the test when you say, and forgive me my sins as I forgive those who sin against me? Do you really want that? Do you have grudges in your life? Do you carry around anger and hatred towards other people? Jesus says, blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. If we are merciful to others, we too will obtain mercy from God. Matthew 6, 14 and 15. Matthew 5, 8, blessed or happy, that self-contained inner happiness, happy are the pure in heart, for they will see God. You want to have that inner happiness? Have a pure heart. It can start right now. In Acts 15, it says, control the heart and you control the man. Now, we're not talking the physical heart. We're talking the spirit. We're talking about the attitude. We're talking about the behaviors. So God, who knows the heart, made no distinction between us and them, purifying their heart by faith. You want to purify your heart? Demonstrate your faith. Live your faith. Let the mercy that you extend to others be an indicator of the faith you have in God, that He will take that relationship that is ruined and restore it, and not allow you to carry that burden with you. You want true happiness? Have a pure heart. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will become children of God. In Proverbs, chapter 6, verses 16 through 19, we're told that there are six things that God hates and seven that He abhors. One of them that God hates that's specifically mentioned is the brother who creates division and dissension in the brotherhood. We all knew them. When I went to high school, junior high, and also when I taught in the public schools, there was always that one or two kids that they may not be the ones that were in there fighting, but you could guarantee that they were going to be within 10 feet of it. They were the ones that were going over during lunch or after gym and saying, "You know what? Logan said this about you." Maybe Logan didn't even know about it. Or they may look at the other guy and say, "Logan, I think you can take him." And try to set up that squabble, try to set up that dissension amongst the ranks. God hates that. He hates those who backbite and gossip and try to create trouble amongst the congregation. Paul goes further and says, whenever possible, as the sons of God, we must be at peace. In Romans chapter 12, he says, if possible, as much as it lies within you, live peaceably with all men. I like that he put that in there that says, as far as it lies within you. Because there are some people, and Satan will put them in your path, who will not let there be peace. And what are we to do as Christians? Well, he's already indicated that we're to take wrong peacefully and patiently. As far as it is up to us to do the right thing all the time. You think it doesn't work? A number of years ago, in one of the commands that I had overseas, I had a couple of people in my squadron that were creating all kinds of problems for me personally and for a couple of others. I took this to heart, and I will tell you that it wasn't always easy, but I continued to do the right thing by them and by other people. I left that assignment, had a couple of assignments later, and at one point, though, I had a phone call from the guy who had been my top enlisted aide. He said, "You really made an impression on me. You went through about 3 months there where I don't know that I would have had the patience that you did. But because you had that patience, it has affected me in the way I treat other people, and it had a positive effect on the rest of the squadron because of what you did." Excuse me. It is up to us to set the standard for the world. God created us for the world, not the world for us. We are here to show the world how to live. Romans chapter 14, verse 19, it says, "Therefore, let us pursue the things that make peace and the things by which we may edify one another." One of our jobs as Christians is to establish peace and to edify and to encourage others. My granddaughter, sitting up here on the front row, one of the things she does, she is a cheerleader at her middle school. That's perfect training to be a Christian, because we are to be cheerleaders for the world. When we go out and we make peace and we edify, do those things that edify one another, we're being cheerleaders for God. Go be a cheerleader for God. "Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." 1 Peter 4:16 says, "Yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in the matter." We will receive those slings and arrows that the world will throw at us. There's going to be people that are going to not necessarily like what we're doing. In Romans chapter 12, and following the thing about being at peace with everybody, it also talks about, because by doing so, you're heaping coals of fire on their head. What does that mean? Have you ever thought about it? Well, what would happen if you were out in the backyard or in your patio and you've got the charcoal grill going, and what would happen if suddenly that charcoal grill dumped out right on top of you. You'd be swinging and batting things back and maybe lashing out at the source of where that pain was coming from. When we practice all of these things, we can expect to be persecuted. There's going to be people who are not living the right way who are going to see us living the right way, and either because of embarrassment or guilt or because Satan has motivated them, they're going to throw things back at us. We should not be surprised when that happens. And yet we see that if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in this matter. Blessed are you, happy are you. This internal happiness comes when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. We've all heard it. Yeah, he's a Christian, but you know about those Christians, right? You can look on TV and you can see all the bad things that various, and whether it happens to be a Catholic priest or a Baptist minister or somebody from our own fellowship, we all get painted with that same brush. People will look at that and say, hey, they're a Christian, you know, there's bad things that go on over there. They may call you a Bible thumper. They may call you all kinds of things, but you know what? That's okay. Because we should take that and be blessed by that and know that we are doing the right thing and know that ultimately they will come around. They will remember that. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. This is nothing new. These are the things that will come about, but we should rejoice in that, because, you know, we are sent here as a peculiar people to do the things that God has us to do. We are to set the standards. We are to show the rest of the world how to live. So what does this life look like? Well, Paul kind of sums it up for the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Beginning in verse 9, he says, "Now about your love for one another, we do not need to write to you, for you yourselves have been taught by God to love each other. And in fact, you do love all of God's family throughout Macedonia. Yet we urge you, brothers and sisters, to do so more and more." You see, the Thessalonians, Paul recognized that the Thessalonians had love for one another, and it was evident not only in Thessalonica, but through all of Macedonia, which is in that area that we now know as Greece, all along the Aegean Sea, the Philippians, the Bereans, all of those. Everybody knows. It's very evident to us that you love one another. And make it your ambition to lead a quiet life, to mind your own business and work with your hands. Now, why would God say that? Why would he say to live a quiet life? Aren't we to be bold for Jesus? Yes, we are. But living a quiet life, as it's talking about here, is don't stir up division. Don't go out and cause trouble. In fact, it says, mind your own business. You know what? If we mind our own business, gossip goes down to zero. We're to mind our own business. It says work with our hands, and at the time that was the primary way that people worked, but it says dedicate yourself to your work. Do those things so that your daily life, let's say that again, so that your daily life may win the respect of outsiders, and so that you will not be dependent on anybody. See, this is all about how we live our daily life. The Beatitudes that Jesus has talked about all this time refers to how we should live our lives, the things that we should do, and how we can win the respect of each other. Jesus was no common man. Just as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus didn't come to be served. He resisted any time somebody talked about him becoming that earthly ruler that the Jews were looking for. every time they tried, Satan tried to exalt him and give him control and dominion. We all remember the challenges as he fasted in the desert. But Jesus always knew that his job was to serve, not to be served. And so it is with us. Jesus came to show us how we should live our lives today. The Beatitudes, if you're wanting a list of how you're to live your life, there you have it. Live that quiet life. Don't create dissension. Follow all of the things that we've talked about here, and you will have that internal happiness, that happiness that comes from within, that happiness, that joy, and the contentment that we find in ourselves, and we don't have to depend on the Ford Motor Company to give us that Mustang and try to pursue happiness, because we know that's going to go nowhere. How about you? Are you happy? Have you been pursuing righteousness? Have you been living your life the way that Jesus would have you? Are you constantly engaged in turmoil and conflict? If you have any needs or anything that we can do for you as a church, if you need the prayers of this congregation, I invite you to come as we stand and sing.